On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We're joined in studio by Gronan the A reporter with the Journal.ie and by Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Good morning to you both. Gronan, I think I saw you nodding your head when I read the headline about the need for Fianna Fáil to be more radical on housing. Do I take it that you believe that they need to do something pretty drastic to get themselves out of the hole?
I think Fianna Fáil's problem isn't the polls or isn't the candidate that was in the by-election, but is their lack of a vision or a message to the public. If they solved, if they did something massive on housing, solving the housing crisis is a big ask. You know, it's a bit multifaceted and there's a lot to it. But if they made a massive dent or difference to people's lives, people would see the value in voting for Fianna Fáil again. I think that is the big problem. You know, Fianna Fáil is a party that used to try and deliver for everyone in society. Mm. You know, they tried to be a party for all. That doesn't wash in today's politics.
You think it's
anymore.
Impossible to be a broad church party now?
I don't think so. I really don't, because what's worked well for Fine Gael, which are like a good kind of foil for what you can do as a modern party who's been around for a long time, is they've kind of consolidated who they are as a party. So when I'm voting, I didn't vote in the by-election, but when a person is voting in an election, they know what they're voting for in a Fianna Gael candidate. And Fianna Fáil don't have that, and voters don't like that. And that is part of the problem here. You know, Jim O'Callaghan's comments about housing, it reflects more about a hollow core in Fianna Fáil rather than, you know, Fianna Fáil needing to perform on housing as part of their kind of political need. They need to perform on something, basically, to attract voters to them again.
And housing needs to be it. Mick Clifford, do you agree with that assessment, that it's impossible to be a broad church anymore?
Largely, I would, Gavin, to the extent a broad church in the way Fianna Fáil were for 70 odd years. I think what Gráin is saying, I'd very much go along with it. We have now appear certainly to be moving towards a more pan-European or even broader Western world political system, whereby you have left and right, perhaps centre left, centre right, which is the case in most places, and that would seem to be the case here. And Fianna Fáil's other problem is how things have evolved since the big tumbling they took in 2011. I mean, the confidence and supply from 16 had them seen as a kind of a quasi-ally of Fine Gael's position, and that affected them subsequently. The other thing is, exactly, I agree with Gráin too also in terms of housing is key to everything, but how do you become radical now? And I mean, a very simple one. For example, negotiations for the coalition, one of the things that was on the table from Fianna Fáil and the Greens was the idea of rezoning, and that you no longer have a scenario whereby rezoned land suddenly multiplies exponentially overnight. Yeah. You go back to Kenny and add 25% of the agricultural value, whatever. That is a very obvious move if you want to be any way radical with the provision of housing going forward, as opposed to how it was done. Yet it seems Fine Gael said absolutely no way, and that was shot down. Well, that's just one example. How radical can you be in a coalition?
Well,
like that?
This is it then, because you mentioned housing again. Does it have to be housing? Is housing the one thing that they now have to pigeonhole themselves as, that they have to be the party that's going to sort housing? Or is there anything else out there in the grand panoply of issues that they could claim to be the ones to fix?
Well, I think housing is the most serious issue, and therefore that's the problem. The other issue about housing is, it also speaks to what you might call the socioeconomic divide. I mean, and it would seem that those who, the generation that have to rent in particular, those who need public housing, all of them are being particularly affected in the worst way. People who own their own homes are being least affected. And I'd suggest possibly most likely to vote for Fine Gael, because they'd be seen as best protecting their interests. So Fianna Fáil, I do believe housing is the thing. I just wonder two elements to it. First of all, is it too late to be radical? And secondly, even if they are, the results of that coming true in bricks and mortar, so to speak, within the next 2 or 3 years would be a relatively long shot too. So they're in a bit of a bind.
And it has to be in the next couple of years as well, doesn't it? Because the election is now suddenly ticking around. There isn't like a pause in the 5-year term just because COVID happened. So now they have to get more done in less time.
One of the, you know, that question of does it have to be housing? That is the issue that most people would feel the difference if they made a dent in it. You know, if you look at childcare and if the state kind of took on childcare as an issue that they need to provide for people, people would feel that. But it appeals to a broader spectrum of people if you solve housing. Like, part of the problem with the by-election was, you know, Fine Gael, even though there's you know, affluent homeowners in that constituency, they're worried about their kids not being able to own houses. So like that says a lot about how bad the housing crisis is at the moment, that you have affluent people.
Even those who are most comfortable in society are still worried about it.
Exactly. And that is part of the problem, that we don't have someone addressing that as the crisis that it is, you know, and Fianna Fáil need to.
And to be fair, they are possibly being more radical than they had previously. And in particular, in terms of going back to getting local authorities to build housing, that is actually going on, not at the level it needs to be, but at least they're making moves. But the big issue is radical enough. And one of the most obvious things of all, when you have a body like the ESRI, a very sober analytical body, suggesting you need, I think it was 2 billion was the figure, 2 billion extra needed to invest in public housing. Mm. When they're having to tell the government that about the biggest political issue that's out there,
you know,
there's a problem.
Yeah, a think tank is basically intervening to say this policy.
A state-sponsored think tank, trade union sort of outside thing. This is a.
The ESRI, like, I don't think it's been said often enough that they do not intervene in political debates. This was a housing policy about a crisis in the country, and a think tank said that policy is going to inflate prices after a previous policy did a similar thing, you know, the first time buyer's grant. You know, and it's just kind of cyclical the way it works. It is frustrating for the public to see the government, whatever government it is, tinkering around the edges of a crisis instead of like tackling it head on, which is like the core issue is, you know, Mickey mentioned kind of some of the detail, but the core problem is that the state needs to own more houses in the country.
On that note, actually, we will at some point talk about Ivana Batric and how she managed to pull this off and what it might mean for the Labour Party. But on that note of having to do something with housing and the state having to just be more aggressive, how much of an issue might it have been during the week that we did have that contentious vote in the Dáil where the state was deciding that the new higher stamp duty wouldn't apply to cuckoo funds as long as they rented their new houses back to the state? Because then you have this idea, even criticised by Micheál Martin himself, where the state is paying long-term leases for 20 or 25 years for social housing but doesn't actually own the house at the end of it.
Yeah, well there's a whole debate around the leasing issue, definitely, and it's obviously in the long term you're far better off to buy it rather than to lease it. I think the big thing is it is as of yet unclear to what extent that policy was, or that new regulation or legislation was brought in on foot of lobbying from the funds, and what was as a result of a genuinely straightforward analysis that you had these 2,400 homes that would go without, be in danger of doing so. And I'm not totally across that, but I think that's at the heart of the problem. And whether 2,400 was a notional figure put out there, whether they were really at risk. And I think it's unclear. People are going to take what they want out of that, but I think it's unclear as to the detail whether or not this was as a result of being pressurised by the funds or a genuine worry for those homes this year.
I found it slightly confusing, Gráinne, that they were talking about the risk of people who are currently housed in long-term leasing losing their homes if they were to change the rules in future, because I don't see a cuckoo fund deciding, oh well, if we don't have advantageous tax positions in future, we're going to pull our houses that we have right now. I don't understand how that matters.
Well, I think there's a lot of subterfuge around what is actually happening in practice in relation to cuckoo funds. It like when the story first broke, you know, the state was, or the government was kind of making the argument that this is the way it has to be. We need private companies to kind of intervene. The question you'd have to ask is, well, they're obviously making a profit off of this. And if they're making a profit off of it, then we're losing money to this whole, you know. And there was kind of like a lack of, I suppose, common sense around the government's argument to why cuckoo funds are involved at all.
I mean, to be fair to them, I can absolutely take the argument that they had to come in here initially at a time when we were on the floor. We didn't have a bob to put together. The problem was the laissez-faire attitude afterwards is leave them at it, rather than realising, okay, now, are they still serving our needs, or has the state turned around and begun to serve their needs? And that was left alone, and that was the key
voter,
problem.
If you're a voter, the basic argument between the government and the opposition is that the government is arguing that private enterprise will sort the housing crisis by increasing supply, and opposition is saying that is not enough, the state needs to intervene and produce more measures, more kind of hard-fisted measures to sort it out. And that is the basic argument in the country. So if there is an election, voters need to decide which of those arguments they agree with. And that is the basic reason why the housing crisis hasn't been tackled.
There's one other element, though, and that is there's also a divide people don't like to talk about as those who own homes. The idea that their homes would no longer continue to increase in value makes some voters in that category think as well, and that complicates things.
Because people borrow against their houses, and that's how they then accumulate more wealth in future. Someone on Twitter, by the way, says that it's so nice to have a good old-fashioned political story on the front pages, to which I can only say that nature is healing. The Fianna Fáil TD, James Lawless, has just taken Twitter inside the last few minutes, and it's a fairly lengthy thread in which he obviously congratulates Ivana Bacik and offers commiseration to Deirdre Conroy. On the result itself, I'm reading from James Lawless's Twitter now. Of course, it's disappointing, but one-off elections have a dynamic of their own. In 2011, the presidential election, Fine Gael's Gay Mitchell got 6%, but they went on to lead government for the next 9 years, and they're still in power today. Locals, Euros, by-election, general elections are all different. But we do have challenges and a lot of work to do. We need to communicate what we're doing and to bring people with us. I firmly believe that the right decisions are being made for the right reasons, but we're not explaining that well. And when you're explaining, then you're losing. We need to govern digitally in a digital age, hear the people, engage with them, listen to criticisms, understand people's real fears, hopes and aspirations, and then address them. Get ahead and get to where the people are. There is an opportunity to reshape state and society post-COVID, build back better, greener, smarter. It's a challenging and an exciting time to be in government, but let's grasp the nettle, learn from this, make necessary changes and respond. We will have done the state some service if we do. I'm sure there isn't meant to be a direct echo to Charlie Haughey in that last sentence, but nonetheless, it's very difficult, Mick, though, to disagree with any of that. Just that Fianna Fáil just be better at telling people what you're doing in government.
Yeah, but isn't there an issue too, whenever you hear politicians say, or any group actually, communication is our problem? Well, sorry, it's probably the message is the problem, not the way you're communicating it.
I was about to say, like, I hate that phrase when you're explaining you're losing, because
you should be allowed to explain what you're doing in government. Like, there's space for nuance.
It also undermines the person you're explaining to, which is the public. You know, that we can't take nuance. And I think it's very dismissive. You know, I don't think that people are above being able to understand that, you know, things are complicated and, you know, it's and difficult to sort.
And anything that you do good in housing is going to do ill to someone else. Yeah, that's just, like, the nature of the beast.
Like, if you talk to an average person, they will all have a story of how, you know, whether it's rent or buying or, you know, own like a mortgage, of how it's not working for them. That is not something you're mis-explaining to someone. It's not working for people.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. We will talk, by the way, about the winner of the by-election, Ivana Bacik, and what it means for the Labour Party and AOB. Fianna Fáil don't need a new leader, says Aidan Regan of UCD, a regular contributor to this show on Twitter. They need an identity. Irish politics now has a clear left-right divide and Fianna Fáil don't know where they fit. Let us know your thoughts. On the Record NT is our hashtag on Twitter. 53106 is the number for your texts. Someone else on Twitter says, one thing is for sure, Ivana Bacik will not deliver a single home, which is possibly a reasonable claim to put against an opposition TD, as Ivana Bacik now is, having won that by-election on Friday, which begs a decent question, Mick Clifford, is that if housing is the big issue, why would you elect Ivana Bacik? What's she going to do about it?
Well, housing is a big issue, but I don't think that anybody who got elected was going to deliver an extra house in Dublin Bay South in this by-election. And what you had was Ivana Bacik is somebody who politically has unique aspects to her, in that A, she's a person of serious substance, B, she's a very likeable person, and C, she's been around and kept a head down and faced into a number of electoral failures over the years. And I think people, between it all, people realised her time had come. She's somebody who, when she started out, was at what was then perhaps a radical fringe in terms of issues like marriage equality, the Eighth Amendment, etc. Yeah. All have become mainstream, and I think it all has all coalesced. And I think you'd look long and hard to find anybody who would begrudge her victory in this election.
People of a certain age will remember the case Spook versus Grogan. Spook being the Society for the Prevention or for the Protection of Unborn Children, not the prevention. That's quite the obvious of what they're trying to do. But she was the president of the Trinity SU back in 1989 when they were taken to court over their publication of access to abortion information. So it's a fight that she's been fighting for a long time.
I think that The Independent had a headline that said an overnight success after 22 years, which really summed up kind of Bacik's win, that she has the CV to kind of justify the win. And a lot of the parties that were in the running said that. You know, Leo Varadkar was very, you know, he's like, this is without any kind of concessions. She was a brilliant candidate. And it was really, really tough because she was so well-rounded. Mm. And like, because of her legal background, she's a very good legislator, which is what we need in the Dáil, people to write laws that are going to make the country better.
Actually, the job of legislators is to legislate.
You know, that argument that, you know, she will not, like, there'll be no extra houses, that was, I suppose, the government candidate's argument that, you know, if you want to make change, elect a government TD. But the other side of it is Batchaig is a very efficient active legislator, and that actually does make a difference. You know, there's opposition legislation that goes through the Dáil and is supported by other parties. That actually does make a difference. So I don't think any, like, I think the other parties were almost happy to have her in the Dáil as well, to a certain extent.
Well, the funny thing about Friday was that it's not one of those cases where somebody goes away and licks their wounds and finds it very difficult to say anything nice about the winner. You'd find it very difficult to find anyone in the RDS who didn't have something nice to say about Evanna Batchaig, which is a level of her esteem, at least inside political circles. What I'm fascinated by, though, Mick, is how much of it do you reckon was a personal vote for Evanna Batchaig, and they're looking at her record and a lot of those issues that you mentioned, and looking beyond the party badge? Because again, if it is housing, Labour, yes, are an opposition party, but they're led by a guy who was the Minister for Housing for a while and didn't appear to make much of a dent.
Yeah, and, you know, I have some sympathy for Labour for paying for their sins, so to speak, going back a number of years. But you're right, I think, I don't know, 80-90% of it was the actual candidate. I saw there was some quote came out of RTE on Friday that that perhaps this victory showed that there was an alternative opposition. I think that was completely overstating the victory for them. I mean, it was it is a boost for the Labour Party, but I don't think it signifies anything beyond Evanna Batchaig's personal esteem. What would have been interesting would have been if Kate O'Connell had been put forward by Fine Gael. Mm. It would have been interesting then to see how well she may have done, whether she would have really challenged for the seat or not. And I think it speaks to dodgy stuff in terms of Fine Gael, in terms of how they're managing themselves electorally, and that she was not, that they thought they could put in James Gagan, a relative newcomer. He's a city councillor, fair play to him, and he fought a good fight, but that they thought this was sewn up because traditionally it had been something of a Fine Gael
seat. But then what about then the argument that Leo Varadkar put forward on Friday, which is that Kate O'Connell was welcome to contest the convention if she wanted to, and evidently if there's enough appetite out there for somebody of Kate O'Connell's gender and values and experience, that she possibly could have won the convention.
We all know in politics that feelers are constantly put out, and one would have to suspect that if Kate O'Connell had any interest, and I'd say perhaps she had, I'd be stunned if she hadn't put out feelers, so to speak, she would have sniffed the wind and decided which way it was blowing, and it would have been made plain to her. That would be my opinion, rather than a question of, oh, she didn't want to run, so we threw someone else in.
There is an awful lot written across all today's papers about all different manner of things. There's a lot written, obviously, about the Fianna Fáil and the possibility of there being now a heave, a lot in the Sunday Times and Sunday Independent. There's a lot written about Fine Gael maybe contesting the whole question of whether Kate O'Connell might have run. We need to move on from the by-election, but before we do, Gráinne, is anything that just jumps out from you today of other lines we haven't mentioned yet?
The Fianna Fáil issue is very crucial. You know, obviously everybody has a look at themselves after an election they don't win and sees what we could have done better, even if they win it. You could look at that, and Labour might do that as well. They might try and capitalise on Batchaig's win, but the future of Fianna Fáil as a party is very crucial, and the fact that their best candidate for the leadership of the party, Jim O'Callaghan, or the most likely candidate maybe is a better use of a better phrase, is wishy-washy about wanting to take the leadership, says a lot about where Fianna Fáil are headed. You know, I feel like if that was any other party and there was a leadership thing, they'd be chomping at the bit to try and take over.
I did hear it being suggested, though, that, you know, if Jim O'Callaghan had intended to go on some sort of a listening tour to try and regenerate Fianna Fáil from the grassroots for the next 3 years, that now that's a luxury he doesn't have, because if Fianna Fáil is down to 4.6% in his home constituency, he can't leave Dublin Bay South for the next three years, or else it's his own seat on the line.
Jim O'Callaghan barely got in the last election. It's not like they're particularly strong in that area. But the problem is a wider one with Fianna Fáil about what they stand for electorally. You know, they went into the general election kind of expecting 50 seats, and they ended up with just one above Sinn Féin, and that really bruised them. And I don't think they've properly looked at what happened and what are we doing differently to stop that happening again. And as a party, I just don't know, you know, particularly as a young person who doesn't really see Fianna Fáil's history in anything except a history book, I just don't know why a person of my generation would vote for them as a party.
Mick, what do you read into some of the other parties that we haven't mentioned? For example, the Social Democrats not being able to make a breakthrough again in the constituency that would seem to chime with their worldview, or the Green Party vote going from 22% to 8% this time around?
Yeah, I suppose a fair bit of the Green Party, I'd say, was snapped up by Ivana Bacic. The Social Democrats, you know, they're still a relatively small party. They got 6 seats. Now, some of them were really strong candidates the last time around. I think it's just a matter of time before they themselves and Labour end up coalescing. And I think for both their sakes, the sooner the better. If they are to form any type of an alternative soft left opposition, if you want to put it that way. Sinn Féin did all right. And
yeah,
there's been talk about that they had difficulty moving into the middle class areas. You have to put that in the context that this constituency, possibly the neighbouring one, is the one that are the wealthiest constituencies in the whole state.
Mm.
And they would not have that type of issue moving into relatively middle class areas elsewhere. So they held their own. And the other interesting thing about them was they got the vote out in the working class area, which traditionally had always been a big problem.
You say something that I was about to go and bring up. I'm just going to bring up the spreadsheet that a lot of people have probably spent a lot of the last 48 hours looking at, of the votes so far, or the votes in this by-election. There was one box, I think it's the Pier Street Flats box, where there were 239 ballots cast. And Lynn Boyle and the Sinn Féin candidate got 212 of them. Now, if they're able to galvanise that much of their electorate in the areas where they are going to have a strong electorate, it does bode well for areas outside the leafy parts of Dublin Bay South.
Absolutely, it does. And it also speaks to the traditional thing about the nature of politics and people suggesting that the Dáil and the government were not representative of society as a whole. Mm. The only solution to that is for people to go out and vote. And to be fair to Sinn Féin, what you can say, as shown in this and to a certain extent in the previous general election, their base in working class areas, they were able to, for perhaps the first time going back decades, actually get that vote out. Fianna Fáil, remember, used to be very good at getting that vote out going back to the 30s and 40s, but we're talking about, as Grainne said, long ago history there.
There's a lot of texts that I want to read through. A lot of them are about Fianna Fáil's outlook. But before we talk more about Fianna Fáil, just on Fine Gael, because we've mentioned whether Kate O'Connell might have done better. One tweeter is raising the question of Leo Varadkar. Now, they say it in this way. Didn't Leo feel that Fine Gael weren't doing communication very well back in the day, and now Fianna Fáil think that's their issue? Sweet divine, the vanity. This person clearly suggesting that it's more to do with substance than communication. But it does maybe raise a question, Grainne, about the role of Leo Varadkar, because when he was chosen as party leader 4 years ago, it was on the pretense that he was this kind of electoral stardust, that he was such a good communicator that when it came to a debate or any kind of a public facing thing, that he would wipe the floor with everyone else. And clearly, based on Fine Gael's election results in the meantime, it hasn't worked out that way.
Yeah, he's a very, you know, even if you don't like what he's saying, he's a very straight talker, Leo Varadkar.
Mm.
And that's what people liked about him when he was in just a TD and he wasn't kind of in the upper echelons of the party. And the party thought at the time that that would bode well electorally. I don't know if it's a strategic failure that isn't working for Fine Gael, or it's the fact that they've been in government for 10 years and it's just a hard sell for people when you're in government.
Is his straight talking a problem when it's seen as undermining a partner of equal standing?
That it is a problem, to be honest. And it was much more of an issue at the start of this government's tenure in office, but it's kind of gone by the wayside. You see Micheál Martin doing a lot more interviews and kind of releasing statements to kind of counteract that or dilute it maybe a little bit.
I wonder whether that's straight talking though, that what you're referring to there, or is it strategically Leo?
A lot of the time he's just answering questions that's put to him, so like although it might come across as undermining, it's not like he volunteers. He just kind of decides to wander into a studio like this in one morning and go, oh, by the way, it's going to be July the 26th for indoor hospitality. He's answering the questions that are put to him.
Generally other ministers don't, and like whether it's good or bad, that is the etiquette of being a minister, where you talk around the question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just nearly,
you know, there was a time where they were talking about reopening the pubs before Christmas, I think, and they were about to go into cabinet, and he kind of announced it on the way into cabinet almost. And it was just a bit, you know, It's a respect thing to your party government colleagues.
Well, it's nearly 12 months now, but he did announce the lockdowns in Leash, Offaly and Kildare before they were kind of formally announced by the Taoiseach that afternoon. Lots of texts about the by-election. As much as I can't stand Martin, the dinosaur's around far too long and Callaghan can't stand him, but he's 100% right. Get Martin out. That's from Joe. Another texter says, you should be careful what you wish for as if you're stoking up a civil war in Fianna Fáil. If you think this government collapsing and being replaced by Sinn Féin will be any better for you in the media, you clearly have no understanding of the nature of Trotskyist parties in power. Jane in Dublin 3 says Fianna Fáil are facing the real possibility of only getting 15 to 20 seats next time around. By their actions, potential homeowners and their extended family and friends in every constituency will never vote for them. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are the deluded if they think that anyone accepts their investor-led strategy to deny citizens the most basic right to own their own home at a fair price.
There's a quick thing about Micheál Martin. I think it was Kyle Crowder, Fianna Fáil TD, suggested yesterday he wouldn't be leading them into the next election. I think there's no doubt in the world about that. He won't be leading them into the next election. I think Micheál Martin at this stage is looking, to be fair to him, to do the best he can while he's in government, and I don't think he's looking to the long-term future of Fianna Fáil, but then wouldn't any other leaders in his position be doing so? The other issue is, if they decided suddenly we have to get rid of the leader, we have to save the party, who is arriving on the white horse?
I think he'd already be gone if there was a very obvious successor. And like the Sunday Independent reports that some Fianna Fáil sources are saying that Micheál Martin could stay as Taoiseach but resign as party leader, which is interesting because there is
a general
pandemic.
Richard Mulcahy kind of a split from back in the day. Surely if the Labour Party has any chance of recovery, says one texter, Alan Kelly should step aside and propose Ivana Bacic as the new leader. That would bring him some badly needed kudos. It would gain... Are they?
Yeah.
Are people saying that?
Well, I've heard
not saying that in a kind of a Donald Trump way. Kind
fair,
of a lot of people are saying it.
To be fair to Kelly, I mean, you know, he's softened his image a bit, and he hasn't done too badly as leader since he's gone in there, to be fair.
He is good, but maybe future-wise, Bacic is more...
Absolutely.
This is a text from Dermot. Gavin, is it possible that people thumped the government parties because of their abdication of responsibility to Neffet? No government TD can be interviewed without babbling the line about how we have to follow the advice. Maybe people actually want them to govern instead of the situation that we're now in, where the CMO is more powerful than the Taoiseach.
I wouldn't go along with that, and I'd just point to Exhibit A last December, and they governed rather than listen to Neffet, and we now know what happened then.
The Fine Gael base who are watching their houses rise in value also have their children in their 20s and 30s moving back in with them, so I don't think Fine Gael can take their support for granted. That's from Eugene. I think, to be fair, I know a lot of people would have expected him to win, but in terms of the percentage of the vote, James Gagan was able to win the same percentage as Owen Murphy and Kate O'Connell combined, so he did a reasonable job of being able to shore up their own support, although not maybe reach beyond those sorts of areas. I'm a voter in Dublin Bay South, says one texter. I gave my number one to Ivana. Her passion and her hard work deserve it. I didn't vote for Fianna Fáil. One, I'm still smarting from their part in the last recession and their lack of any coherent message or policy that I can see. Fine Gael is not my natural home, and I'm annoyed with the Greens with the beachfront cycle home. I presume that's the Sandy Mount, mm-hmm. Sandy Mount cycle corridor. All politics being local. To your listener who said that there's only there are no only left and right parties in Ireland, that's not true. This person says there is no major centre or right of centre party in Ireland. The Democrats in the US who are left leaning will consider Fine Gael tax rates to be far left in nature. That is from Lara in Dublin.
That's more about the US though than us.
Gerard Holland makes that point in the Sunday Times today.
I think Mick is very way off the mark, says one texter. Many people in the constituency would have ordinarily voted for Fine Gael but wouldn't have voted for Kate O'Connell because she was seen as very disloyal. It would have gone down like a lead balloon in their voter base if she was on the ticket.
Opinion. I don't agree with it, so maybe that person's better informed than me in the locally.
There's always another election coming, of course. One person says, how will the now empty seat in the Senate be filled? Will Trinity graduates get to vote, or will the Dáil just hold a pretend election? How that will be filled is through a by-election of graduates from the University of Dublin, which means that Trinity graduates now get to vote. It is worth stressing, Gráinne, on this point, you don't have to be a Trinity graduate to be on the ticket, only to vote. So there is the possibility of any candidate who wants to chance their arm now contesting this one. And it could be a more high-profile Shannon election than most, I suspect.
Yeah, it might be. It's a bit like the by-election, I suppose, in the sense that if there's just one seat to be filled, there's a concentrated look at that. I'm flashing back to the Shannon referendum where we were going to do all these reforms to make it a fairer system, and then we were talking about Trinity graduates.
It's absolutely ludicrous, the fact that there's a seat there now and only those who have graduated from Trinity College Dublin.
We don't talk about how we're not reforming the Seanad enough.
I mean, it's insane.
And that's part of the problem. The Seanad is largely
irrelevant. We talk about, you know, how Ivana Bacic was on the calls of some unpopular referendum long before they ever got over the line. It's 1978 or 1979 that we had a referendum on extending the Seanad franchise to other university graduates. Still haven't gotten around to actually legislating for it. Final tweet before I go to a break. Mick on Twitter says, maybe it doesn't matter to Mick Clifford that Labour betrayed the working class with their austerity agenda, but it does matter to those of us who are in the Social Democrats. Homeless families and children eating their food on the streets is not something that we could ever stand over.
A lot of people have been talking about the kind of the effect housing policies and Labour had on people. It really has resonated and stuck with people.
The new vaccine stats are out this morning. We now have 66.5% of people who have had one dose and 53.8% of people who are fully vaccinated. But should the rest of us be left outside while those who are lucky enough to have all of their jabs go indoors for dinner? There is, unsurprisingly, an awful lot written once you get past the by-election coverage about this idea of some sort of vaccine pass or how exactly indoor hospitality is going to work. As I mentioned in my review of the front pages, some of the papers still suggesting that they're on to reopen on July the 19th, others suggesting that they might split the difference and reopen on the 22nd. Other people still believe that even that is too ambitious and that indoor hospitality might only reopen on the 26th. But there is an interesting idea that's been broached inside the last couple of days, which is that you could still be allowed to eat indoors if you are an unvaccinated child or teenager and you go in there with your parents. Now, I'm looking at you, Mick Clifford, precisely because I know that you're the only one of the three of us in studio who's fully vaccinated. Myself and Grania over here in the other level of the lower tier of society are not allowed to go indoors. I'm not sure why it should be allowed. I know that people obviously want to go and dine as families and all of that, but I don't know why it would make sense from a virus management perspective for an unvaccinated teenager to be allowed to go and dine indoors while myself and Grania have to sit outside getting rained on.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. I think they're really, really struggling here in terms of looking for any possible way to allow hospitality sector to open. And not because I'm vaccinated makes no difference to me. I have huge sympathy for the dilemma, because the choice is you leave it closed. In an ideal world, you would do that on the basis of the potential for the variant at the moment and the fact that it is going to overtake the race to have the population vaccinated. In an ideal world, you would leave it closed. The devastation there has been to the sector, I can see why they're doing absolutely everything to open it. Mm. There are huge issues. There are civil liberty issues. There are discriminatory issues. Absolutely there are. And as you say, this is the latest one, because the family dining thing is obviously a very central
I don't mean to sound like I'm dismissing it as well, and I know I framed the question in maybe a way that's unfair. I completely understand that for a lot of people in the hospitality trade, having family diners and family parties all inside is a massive part of it, and a lot of people won't sit outside if that's their option. It's either indoors or nowhere.
No, you also have the issue of, you mentioned teenagers, well, you go into young kids in that area, the transmissibility, the volume of it, I would imagine, and there is an awful lot less, and therefore perhaps, again, you see, there is no ideal solution. Yeah. They're playing with this, playing with that, seeing what's the possibility to make the most. And you have to remember as well, in terms of the hospitality sector, come the end of August, that's it for a huge parts of the country. Bang, it's gone for another year. And as I say, it is a serious dilemma. I understand the issues, but I can understand why they appear to be advancing the way they are at the moment.
Grania, I know that, again, I kind of framed that question slightly unfairly, and that you and I are going to have to reconcile ourselves to outdoor drinking and dining for a little while. But you kind of, you do understand, though, that, like, the bind that people now find themselves in. If the government is wedded to trying to allow the sector to reopen, and to reopen in a sustainable way that isn't going to risk another closure again as cases begin to mount up, that if the only way to do that is to allow family units to all dine indoors together, then it does make a lot of financial sense, even if it doesn't make an awful lot of viral sense.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the government are doing this says a lot about, you know, what Mick was saying about how hard hit the sector has been, that they really, it's legally complicated, it's morally complicated, it's risking, you know, it's a little bit more risky virus-wise, and opening up is just so tricky because you're kind of clashing advice in a lot of ways, but it's about keeping a certain amount of risk at all times. But the fact that they're willing to do all of that to open it up says a lot about how they feel that the sector is hard hit.
Yeah.
And it's just worth it. There, you know, all these complications and, you know, public health guidance about the virus spreading isn't smooth or isn't complimentary a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And even that, they're saying it's probably worth the risk. I think there's a good column or a good point raised by Tony O'Brien in Sunday Business Post about antigen testing, about how that could help things a little bit along the way. But, you know, the fact that they're thinking of using the COVID digital cert to prove you're vaccinated, but you can't use the same cert to say you've a negative test to get in.
Yeah.
It's really contradictory.
I thought that this was very revealing when during the week when it emerged that they are no longer considering the idea of allowing you indoors on the basis of a negative test. Because as you rightly say, if they're going to use the app or the infrastructure that they're already building for travel, if that's now going to be co-opted for internal use in the hospitality sector, that app is already supposed to have some kind of functionality where you go and take a test in an accredited lab. The lab feeds the result back to the government and the government basically tops up your passport and says you're good to go for the next 3 or 4 days. And if they can't do it for hospitality, how on earth are they going to be able to do it in an airport tomorrow week?
Yeah, and didn't they say that time is one of the issues? This is something that they should have been getting down to months ago, but that's definitely contradictory. There's no question about it.
But do you think they should have been planning for it or should have been sounding out the technicalities of this a few months ago, even at a point where they were steadfastly refusing to consider any kind of a system where the vaccine would get you more things domestically?
I do on the basis that you look particularly in Europe and some countries were considering and were going down that route already. And I mean, I can understand why they kept saying they wouldn't do it, but you have to plan for all eventualities. Now, that's easy to say, but there has overall been an issue at various junctures where there's been a lack of planning.
I think that is why that, you know, when people say NPHET are in charge, government has kind of like left a lot of the decision making to them, and that's great or easy for them to do. But the fact that they didn't have this prepared shows how much they're relying on NPHET's advice without actually planning a little bit for what they could advise themselves. Yeah. And they kind of blame, they were like, oh, this is dropped out of the sky. But as the people running the country, the government should have prepared for this type of situation.
There is
particularly
one other thing,
looking abroad.
There is one other thing, and it's Justine McCarthy has an excellent column on it in the Sunday Times today, and that is the fact that absolutely this is important, it's vital for the sector, for tourism, etc. But it is not life and death stuff, as has been portrayed by various lobby groups, and particularly an awful lot of politicians, opposition politicians in particular, using language like horrendous and gutted and the whole thing. And, you know, things have to be put in context of a pandemic where thousands of people have died, not to mention all the other fallout.
The question is, if we open indoor dining and that risks everything else that is open at the moment, is that worth the risk? Yeah. You know, we have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, Justine's piece opens quite well because she's recalling some of those TV news quizzes sometimes where you see people being shown the headlines and they have to guess what the story is about. The following is a selection of adjectives that swamped the airwaves and newspapers in response to a recent event in Ireland. Horrific, devastated, heartbreaking, gutted, horrendous, catastrophic, shocked. Can you guess what they were talking about? Maybe they were talking about the news that more than 2,000 people have died during the third wave after restrictions were lifted to facilitate a meaningful Christmas. Maybe they were talking about how the Grim Reaper, scythed through the country's nursing homes in the first wave. Might they have been lamenting the untold numbers of mostly younger people who continue to be stricken by the chronic effects of long COVID? No, the catastrophe they were talking about was the government's prudent decision to postpone the reopening of indoor hospitality because the fourth wave was knocking on our door. Now, in fairness, we do have a text from a publican, and you can understand the text, the bind that this publican is in as well. He says that our raison d'etre is to create an atmosphere to encourage people to return time and time again. And you do that by creating a space that's supposed to make you forget the grind of everyday life. This would be the death knell to all of that time restraints and so on and so on. What about Denmark, for Christ's sake? You can sort of understand the point there, Mick, that if they want to reopen, they want to reopen as almost as escapism from COVID. And if you reopen a pub, which is almost the embodiment of COVID restrictions, then it doesn't feel very much like a pub.
Well, yeah, but again, you're talking about degree. And I mean, basically, okay, if we could go back to a scenario that was here pre-COVID in terms of atmosphere and all, but that's too big a leap. Everything has to be by some degree equally, as they say, between this vaccinated unvaccinated divide. The notion that you just go back to have no time restrictions ranting, it's too much of a leap. It's too much of a leap at the moment where things are at.
Well, here's the other side of that same view. We have a texter, Linda, who is 60 and just got her second vaccine yesterday, and she can assure you that while I might consider dining outdoors in a restaurant, there is not a hope of me going indoors, especially if unvaccinated under 18s are allowed to dine in there as well. If they're going to allow that, they may as well open indoor dining to all. The risks are there either way. It should be vaccinated only for all. It makes no sense. That is from Linda. Someone else, by the way, says that any chance of the media talking about a small but significant sector, which is other indoor activities like play centres, bowling alleys, for example, completely overlooked and forced to close. Thanks. Which is a fair point, Grainne, because we talk about hospitality, but that really, by right, if this is going to be a workable solution, then you should also be allowed to open any other indoor facility like a play centre to the vaccinated only. Although how a play centre would work when it's mostly for children who can't be vaccinated, I don't quite know.
Oh, the transmissibility would be low among children would be the argument for keeping them open. But it's the kind of the core message that we've gotten from NPHET and the government this summer is that indoor is a lot more risky than outdoors, and ventilation is obviously, you know, another thing that hasn't, you know, talking about things that haven't been talked about enough. Ventilation, it sounds very boring, but it's actually crucial to opening indoor activities enough. And there was a controversy this week about summer camps not being able to held indoors because the advice wasn't really clear.
That
enough.
Advice came very late in the day, didn't it?
Halfway through the summer.
Got my second AstraZeneca jab yesterday. Never seen as many over 60s in one place in my life in City West. A brilliant job and well done to all. That's from Joe. I think I saw it being reported inside the last 12 hours or so. City West alone has now administered 250,000 vaccines, which is some going for a facility that only opened a few short months ago. So well done to everyone involved in there. Before we go, Mick, this is going to require some legislation to go through the door this week so that restaurants or hospitality would have a legal basis by which they can turn diners away and only seat them outdoors if they're not vaccinated. Could that be a political issue just in terms of the government parties actually getting the votes over the line?
I would have thought they'd get it over the line. I would have thought so in this instance. Where it'll become an issue is perhaps a legal issue. Or you're going to see it challenged.
But you don't see there being any shortage where TDs who have vocally cast out, including from the government parties, who have questioned this idea of having what they see as a two-tier society, you think their votes are still okay?
I think they get it over the line. I think so. On the basis, you're back again to, well, I mean, put it this way, the same TDs are going to be lobbied by the hospitality industry, understandably, completely, and I think it would be a major defeat if they didn't get it over the line.
I think the general consensus is, as much as they have qualms about the inequality of it, if industry reps are in favour of it, government TDs will vote in favour of it.
Mm. And if you like, I can hand a plate out the window to the pair of you outside.
That's very generous.
So kind of you. Some EU countries like Malta, for example, only allow in vaccinated visitors now. They're not even accepting a proof of a negative PCR test. That's from one listener. Someone else says that school buildings have magical powers, clearly, if they're perfectly all right to have so many unvaccinated people indoors in.
It's that the risk is worth the effort there because education is so important.
Exactly.
The education sector, people keep talking about we need to close the schools. It is so important that kids get educated at the time in their lives that they do. Without question that we need to have the schools open by September.
It's vital, but particularly in relation to socioeconomically, those most disadvantaged are the ones who have disproportionately huge effects.
Yes. Kids are already disadvantaged by the time they have lost in school or have been learning over Zoom or whatever you have online, because it's not the same. Teachers have, and you know, the stress of like the pandemic has taken a hit on their education as well. Without question, we need kids in school.
You can understand though why teachers get very annoyed in the last couple of weeks when they see such concern around unvaccinated barmen who are now working in an environment which is apparently unsafe, and yet teachers have been offering similar service to unvaccinated people for months now.
And a lot of teachers are young. A lot of young teachers who aren't vaccinated are facing the prospect of going back to school in August, September and not being fully protected, which is obviously not great either, and that is down to the government missing its targets to get vaccinated. This should have been sorted by now.
We are completely out of time, I'm afraid. There's loads more text. I might get to them when we're talking to Kingston Mills after 12 o'clock. But for now, Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner, thank you very much. Grainne the A, reporter with the journal.ie, thank you very much.